Move next to the third case of the morning, 06-43-23, United States versus Timothy Stewart. In this case, we welcome back for the third time. We'll hear first from Mr. Vincent.
I thought everybody here was here for this case.
Shows the lack of interest in your argument.
Really, in the really important issues. May it please the court, Joshua Vincent on behalf
we'll
of the
state. We'll stay here, though.
That is a great comfort to me, Judge. For the record, Josh Vincent on behalf of the defendant, Timothy Stewart, and with me at counsel table is Ms. Kim Jansen, who does all the heavy lifting. Your Honors, we're here today to review the district court's determination that Miranda warnings were not deliberately withheld from Mr. Stewart before the police elicited his confession to a bank robbery. There is a dispute between the parties over the applicable standard of review, but in all honesty, I don't think you even need to reach or decide that question because there is clear error on this record, and that comes springing from this case by the fact that the district court made absolutely no determination with respect to the intent of Detective Winters. And here you have a 16-year veteran of the department who admitted in his testimony that he knew Mr. Stewart was in custody from the get-go when he re-handcuffed him in that car to take him downtown, who participated actively in the interrogation of Mr. Stewart, who had him in a locked facility and participated in the interrogation there in the interview room, and in fact was there right up until the 2 or 3 minutes before Mr. Stewart ultimately confessed to the robbery and never gave him a Miranda warning. There
well,
is no discrimination.
Whether we believe that or not is not really the issue, and that's what it sounds like you're arguing.
No, what I'm arguing,
what
Judge.
What the judge below said was that he found the officer's explanation credible and that it was not a deliberate end run around Miranda.
Excuse me, Judge. He made no determination regarding Detective Winters. There's two detectives involved here. He made a determination about Nelson, and I'm going to talk about that in a minute while that's clear error. But with respect to Winters, who is the other officer who actively participated in this interrogation, right up to the point where Mr. Stewart made incriminating statements specifically about stealing the car for the robbery and obtaining the gun for the robbery, Winters is there. And there is nothing in the record. There is no finding. The government even concedes there's no evidence explaining why Winters didn't give a Miranda warning. But there's absolutely no determination by the district judge with respect to Winter's intent. And the whole purpose of the Seibert case is this question of the withholding of the warnings undermining their effectiveness once given. And if you have two detectives actively participating in this interrogation, and one of them admits he knows this man is in custody and entitled to those warnings and does not give them and provides no explanation for it, it's the government's burden. I mean, there's no dispute here. The government bears the burden of proving that there was not a deliberate withholding. They admit they put on no evidence whatsoever to explain why Winters didn't give the warnings. And he was there right through to the incriminating statement that led to the confession only a few minutes later.
Was he doing the interrogation? Was he asking any questions? I thought the record was that Nelson was asking the questions and Winters was there.
The record, fairly construed, I think the record indicates that Nelson was lead, but Winters was there and participating. And in fact, Winters is the person who questioned initially at the perimeter checkpoint and in the car once they were there. And Winters started the whole process. He's the one who re-handcuffed him and put him in the car.
Right, but once he was in custody and subject to Miranda warnings, after that point, did Winters ask any questions?
Oh, yeah, they're both definitely asking him questions in the interview room. It's not just a situation where Winters is sitting there like a potted plant and Nelson is doing all the questioning. I mean, I think the record fairly indicates that Winters was an active participant in the interrogation. Fair. Okay. But even if you want to put that aside, let's go to the question of Nelson's subjective intent. Because the district court made a determination that that was credible. And what was Nelson's explanation for why he didn't give the warnings? I was in too big a rush to get out of the room and get information out on dual felders, be on the lookout, a BOL for dual felders. I forgot. And the FBI arrived and there was so much chaos and confusion, it just slipped my mind. Not credible. And I'll tell you why. Because there's something very specific that, you know, it's subtle, but you need to parse the record in this case very carefully. Nelson's statement that he left the room to put out information on Felders is false. It does not jibe with the testimony that Winters gave or the testimony that the FBI agent Williams gave.
The district judge made a clear finding that Nelson was credible in the testimony that he gave.
He made that finding. But that, you know, to me, clear error doesn't mean that it's insulated from review. And you've got a record here where Nelson's testimony, when you look at the record, is completely inconsistent and false. He says, I left the room to go give information on Felder to put out the BOL. Winter said that's what he did. So what you need to do is you need to compare four pages of the record, and I'd ask that you take a look at these. This is the record on remand, pages 15 and 16, page 81 and page 120. That's the point where you will see it clear that Nelson's explanation as to why he forgot that he was in a rush to get out of the room can't be true. It can't be true because that's what Winters did. And the FBI says Nelson didn't come out of the room when Winters did. Nelson came out, didn't do anything about putting out a BOL. He talked to the FBI agents, and they went right back in and continued the interrogation, and that's when they broke him.
But I assume that that argument is made to the district judge on why Nelson's testimony should be rejected as incredible. Wasn't that argument made? I would assume it had to be.
I would say
and over
that,
that argument, the judge said, I find
there's no question that Mr. Brinson on remand made the argument that Nelson's testimony was not credible. But I think the simple fact that the district court has made a credibility determination doesn't end the inquiry. If the testimony that the district judge is finding credible is so obviously inconsistent with what the testimony other witnesses have given, then I think it leaves the compelling conclusion that a mistake has been made. And I think that we got to step back, too, from the standpoint of what is the overall standard of review here, which is de novo on the deliberateness issue. And from that point, let's look, I mean, take a look at what we have here, putting aside just the question of Nelson's subjective intent. I mean, we've got clear legal error by a judge who didn't consider the intent at all of the other officer who participated in this interrogation right up to the point of the confession. But putting all that aside and looking at this, stepping back and looking at it from the standpoint of a de novo standard of did the government meet its burden of proving deliberateness in this case? What do you have? You've got two police officers with a combined experience of 30 years. You are in a state of Indiana where the Indiana Supreme Court has held since 1995 that somebody who's in the back seat of a cop car with handcuffs on is in custody. They've got a guy at the perimeter checkpoint who matches the description physically, right down to the haircut, of the person that Officer Sitzman saw fleeing from the bank with the gun and the money. This man is now being taken downtown. He's not given any warnings. He's taken downtown. He's questioned in the squad car all the way downtown about whether he committed the robbery. He's not warned. He is taken into a locked facility where he is questioned further, and he's not warned. He starts to implicate someone else and then implicates himself by saying, I stole the car and bought the gun that was used in this robbery, and he's still not warned. Then finally, one officer steps out to put out a BOL. A moment later, the other officer steps out, sees the FBI out there, and says, hey, fellas, this guy's about to break. Come on in. They go inside. The FBI announces themselves that there's going to be federal charges. The defendant starts to cry. And at that point, is he warned? No. He's not given any Miranda warnings. Instead, Nelson persists. He says, did you commit the robbery? And he extracts a confession. Did you do it alone? Yes. Now he gives the Miranda warnings. That compels the conclusion that these warnings were deliberately withheld. I think this is an extremely significant case.
So your point would be, when the judge made his credibility finding, he said that he just innocently forgot because he rushed out of the room. I guess your point would be then, why wasn't he Mirandized once he came back?
Precisely.
And he was with the FBI agents at that time.
Precisely.
So
the
now
reason,
everything's back on track. They've provided the information about who this other person is, and now
exactly.
You're back in the room, the FBI is there, and somebody should have...
Exactly. The rush is over. I mean,
and
after
there's
he's
no mention
rushed
of that.
Out, yeah, the chaos
let
is
let
done.
Let me stop you from it. There's
sure.
No mention of that in the district judge's findings.
None whatsoever. He completely overlooks it, besides overlooking Detective Winters. There was, you know, as I said, it's a significant case. When you read the testimony of Detective Nelson, look closely. The man He's impeached, okay? Page 130. When you read his testimony in the remand, it's short. He is coy. He is evasive. They scanned this defendant. There is no question you come away from this record. I mean, before we even had the remand that this court ordered, you go all the way back 4 years ago to Stewart 1, we raised this issue before the Supreme Court even decided Seibert. I mean, that's how obvious the withholding of the Miranda warnings were, I think, in this case. I think you need to send a message down to the Evansville Police Department that Miranda holds and this court enforces it. We ask you to please reverse. Thank you.
Mr. Vaughn.
Good morning. My name is Joe Vaughn. I'm the Assistant United States Attorney who prosecuted Mr. Stewart before the district court, and who also had the pleasure of appearing before Your Honors on the two prior occasions on Stewart 1 and with Stewart 2. First of all, as to the overall standard of review regarding a deliberate intent to circumvent Miranda, the government submits that should be, it's a finding of fact reviewed for clear error. This court has not previously addressed that matter. However, the government provided this court with authorities pursuant to a Rule 28J letter that other circuits have in fact considered the standard of review, most specifically the Ninth Circuit in Narvaez-Gomez. Ninth Circuit said, we're the only court to our knowledge who has addressed this issue. We find it to be a determination of fact to be reviewed for clear error. Regarding the district court's failure to make a specific finding regarding the impact or ramifications of Detective Winters' failure to have on his own advised Mr. Stewart of his Miranda rights, I think we need to start off by focusing on the remand that came from this court in Stewart 2. And this court directed that on the issue of deliberate intent, the primary focus of the inquiry was the officer's explanation for the failure to give Miranda warnings and the credibility of that explanation in light of the totality of the relevant surrounding circumstances. There's no question that district court did not make a specific finding regarding the reasons why Detective Winters did not advise Stewart of his Miranda rights. The court obviously was aware of that fact, that that event had happened, but did not make a finding. That is probably partially my fault, in the sense of, on the remand, my interpretation and my focus on the case on the remand was on Detective Nelson. He was the individual who had, he was the lead detective for the Evansville Police Department. He was the primary interrogator. He was the individual who elicited the pre-Miranda statements, advised Stewart of his Miranda rights, and then elicited the post-Miranda statement. Regarding Judge Sykes' question regarding the specific role of Detective Winters, there's no question he's present. I believe the district court made a finding that Detective Winters had participated in the pre-Miranda questioning, but the record does not reflect any specific questions that were asked by Detective Winters. I'd also like to point out that while the government, as far as the evidence presented on the remand, did not focus on the specific intent of Detective Winters in not advising Mr. Stewart of his Miranda rights, Mr. Stewart, in his own proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law, did not advocate or present a finding of Detective Winters' individual intent in not advising Mr. Stewart of Miranda. Instead, he lumped everything together in terms of the officer's failure to warn of Miranda and the officer's intent, officer being plural. In Mr. Stewart's reply brief, for the first time he raised an issue that the failure of the court to make a finding regarding the reason why Detective Winters did not advise Stewart of his Miranda rights gives rise to an inference of some kind of deliberate intent which the government failed to rebut. If you take a look at the side, number one, that argument was raised for the first time in a reply brief, which precludes its consideration before this court. Should the court consider the inference argument, I did a word search on the Seibert opinion, and the word inference only appears one time in that opinion, and that is in Justice Souter's opinion on page 613, which is in a different context, where he specifically states that advising a defendant of Miranda following an unwarned statement without advising the defendant that the pre-Miranda statement cannot be used against him gives rise to an inference that the pre-Miranda statement could be used. The inference argument comes from the Ninth Circuit in the Williams case, where the Ninth Circuit stated that to determine deliberate intent, the court should consider whether objective and subjective evidence supports an inference of deliberate intent. As this court knows, it defines an inference as being looking at one fact to reasonably conclude another. And here there are no facts on which to find that Detective Winter's failure to advise Stewart of his Miranda rights was a deliberate circumvention of Miranda.
And now, the district judge said that, you know, there was this rush. I mean, he found Nelson credible. He was rushing outside to get the FBI, to let them know what lead he had developed and what Stewart had said. Why didn't Nelson Mirandize him when he returned to the interrogation room and the FBI agents were there? Or why didn't he ask the FBI whether they had Mirandized him? It seems that reason was gone. He had already passed that information on. They're back starting the interview. Why didn't he Mirandize him then?
Detective Nelson's testimony was he did not advise Mr. Stewart upon his immediate return to the interview room for two reasons. One was he was distracted by the entrance of FBI agents Williams and Beck into the interview room. And number two, it was his belief that this was now an FBI investigation. And the question really comes down to then, was that a credible belief? Now, the district court did not make a factual finding on that particular point. Mm-hmm. I would submit, however, that those explanations are entirely believable and credible.
Well, but see, that's the problem I have.
Okay.
There's no finding by the district court then. Okay. The district court says in terms of credibility before then, I understand it was a rush, you know, you're trying to get this out, you know, you forgot. You know, even though I think the district court the district court clearly has credited that testimony, but there's no finding on this return. I understand you've got an explanation for it, but we don't have a finding.
And so, you're exactly right on that. And I think that kind of, by way of analogy, is where it almost becomes a question of an infinite parsing of a series of facts, where you have a district court you have a series of events, and the court makes a series of factual findings. And let's say they're numbers 1 through 20. Well, it goes up on remand, and then the issue becomes, well, wait a minute. Factual finding 19, that really consisted of three parts, and he didn't make a finding on B or C. Comes up on appeal, sent back to make a factual finding on 19, B, and C. Court does that. It comes back again. Aha!
Right, but see, here we have a different factual scenario. There are many opportunities where, when you look at experienced detectives, he should have been advised or could have been advised, you know, when he first gets in the car, when they have him in handcuffs, you know, no question that he's in custody at some point when he's in the car. No warning. He gets there, they get him in the room, no warning. They ask questions. I mean, we have a whole series of questions and answers back and forth. And so this issue, I don't think it's what you're saying, you know, 20 different points. The question is, what's the critical issue? And it seems to me that's distinguishable from what you're trying to.
Okay. And I think the attempt to follow up on that is that the ultimate issue really is the credibility of Detective Nelson's belief regarding Stewart's custody, and I think we've addressed that. Now we're at the point where Nelson admits, hey, he was in custody. I made a mistake. He explains the reason for the mistake. For whatever reason, the district court did not make a finding on the credibility of that explanation. I submit, though, that in light of the detailed factual findings that were entered by the court, that had the district court found that to be incredible, it would have so stated, and we don't have that kind of a finding that was made by the court rejecting that testimony. That somehow the government failed in its burden of proof on these issues, In Stewart's opening brief, the only time that the issue of the sufficiency of the government's proof arises on page number one, issue number one, at the bottom of the page in a one-sentence statement of issue number one. That issue of the government's burden of proof doesn't appear anywhere else in the balance of the brief. It's never addressed again. The sufficiency of the government's proof is a perfunctory, undeveloped argument, unsupported by any legal authority, and that argument is precluded from consideration by this court. I believe that I am out of time, and I would ask the court to affirm the judgment of the district court that Mr. Stewart's pre-Miranda statement, there was no deliberate intent to circumvent Miranda. The pre-Miranda statement was voluntary. The district court properly admitted the statement under both Seibert and Elstad, and the government would ask this court to affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Vinson, your time has expired, but we'll give you another minute if you...
I just want to respond to 2 points.
And could you respond to that request about your not making a request for findings on Winters?
It's not our burden of proof in this case to give an explanation to explain why Nelson didn't give the warnings. I mean, the government concedes in its brief, and it's always been understood, the district court found, the government has the burden of showing that the warnings were not deliberately withheld. So it was up to the government to introduce the evidence to explain why Nelson didn't give the warnings after he came back in the room and the forgetfulness and the rush and the chaos and all that was over. They didn't elicit the evidence. You know, I may not do criminal work day in and day out, but in the world I live in, you don't carry your burden of proof, you lose. You don't get another kick at the cat under those circumstances. So they knew what their burden was. It's been their burden all along. It's not a question of the district court not making a finding. It's a question of the fact that the government never tried to explain why the warnings weren't given at the critical point Your Honor has identified. The other point I wanted to address is this issue about Detective Winters. Now, with respect to Detective Winters, I don't think it makes a difference whether he's there asking questions or not. The point of Seibert is he's there, he knows this man is in custody, he knows this man is being interrogated, and he knows he deserves the warnings, and he doesn't give the warnings. You can't have a rule of law that allows a police officer to sit there during their interrogation and withhold the warnings under those circumstances while the incriminating evidence is elicited by his partner. That can't be the rule of law. We would ask that you reverse.
Thank you. Mr. Vinson, thank you to you and your firm for accepting the appointment and so vigorously representing your client.